consists of four components: the Arrow interceptor missile, the Green Pine radar, Communication Control Command Center, and Launch Control Center. The system also uses the American Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, system and is movable. The radar can detect 30 targets at very high altitudes while traveling over 9 times the speed of sound. They claim that the newer version of the system can track ballistic missiles up to a range of 600 kilometers. The system calculates the ballistic trajectory of launched missiles and destroys them when they are on its path. The Arrow intercepts missiles in the uppermost layer of the atmosphere or beyond to prevent the spread of chemical or nuclear materials over occupied territories. On October 31, 2023, Israel claimed to have destroyed Yemen's long-range ballistic missile, and on November 9, Arrow 3, Israel's most advanced anti-missile system, reportedly intercepted a Yemeni medium-range missile near the port of Eilat. Each Arrow system contains 2 to 8 missiles and takes an hour to reload. At a lower layer is the David Sling missile system, designed to counter missiles with a range of 70 to 300 kilometers, including Hezbollah's Katyushas, Qassam rockets, and Iran's tactical missiles. The system costs about $2 billion funded by American taxpayers to protect Israel. David Sling is designed to intercept and destroy targets at altitudes ranging from several meters to 15 kilometers above the ground, even if the targets travel at speeds up to 7 times the speed of sound. The radar range of David Sling exceeds 470 kilometers. The system contains 12 missiles and is capable of engaging ballistic missiles. Each David Sling missile costs $1 million and functions by directly hitting the attacking missile. In the final stage, there's the Iron Dome. Each rocket costs $50 million and each missile costs $20,000. The Iron Dome is designed to shoot down targets such as mortars and rockets, which are often fired from Lebanon and Gaza. It is supposed to be most useful for protecting the cities near Gaza, as a large number of low-cost rockets are launched from the Gaza side. There are also THAAD and Patriot systems between Iran and occupied territories. THAAD combines features of all other systems and can engage targets at all altitudes. It is the exclusive interceptor for the United States and NATO. THAAD can intercept any target up to a range of 1,000 kilometers. The radar has 2 search modes, forward base and terminal base. In forward mode, the base is installed near the borders of the hostile country to estimate the direction of the missiles immediately after they are fired. A radar of this type has been installed in Turkey, with another one in the occupied territories. In base mode, the radar is responsible for detecting and guiding anti-missile systems up to a range of 1,000 kilometers. When that is linked with a satellite, its range increases significantly. Furthermore, the Patriot system is located between Iran and Israel. The optimized Patriot has a missile with a smaller warhead that can reach higher altitudes, about 20 kilometers. The Patriot system forms a large dome next to THAAD, which has a range of 200 kilometers. Before the first Persian Gulf War, THAAD and the Patriot systems had not been tested on the ground. When Saddam Hussein started using Al-Hussein and Al-Abbas ballistic missiles, then U.S. President George Bush claimed they had intercepted 39 of the 40 missiles fired. However, on February 25, 1991, one of these missiles hit the Dahran base in Saudi Arabia, killing 28 U.S. soldiers. The U.S. president and military were concealing a secret. The Patriot system was supposed to distinguish whether a missile was fired at a sensitive target or towards the desert and would not fire it if there was no danger. This system wasn't 100% effective, and as a result, only 25 of the 88 missiles fired by Iraq were intercepted. The Patriot system did not engage the rest. After the 1991 invasion, the United Nations banned Iraq from continuing its long-range missile program. However, in 2003, former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein secretly decided to build a missile with a range of 150 kilometers. That year, he acquired two tactical missiles. Previously, Iraq used Scud missiles, which were modified into Al-Hussein and Al-Abbas missiles by combining two Scuds. The Al-Abbas missile was intended to have a range of 1,000 kilometers, but failed, and the project was abandoned after the first Persian Gulf War. In 2003, the new missiles did not work, and the U.S. destroyed all of them after occupying Iraq. Iraq then built the Al-Samud missile, but it did not achieve satisfactory results. These were low-quality rockets intended to be combined with a few remaining rockets from the war. The Patriot system was the most successful among them, meaning Iran had to face the most complex defense systems in history. This also included air-launched missiles from fighter jets. What did Iran possess in order to overcome this size of defense system? It had completed the reverse engineering of the Scud missiles imported from Libya and developed the Shahab-1 missile with a range of about 300 kilometers. Military sources claimed Iran handed over its Shahab arsenal to Oman, Syria, and Hezbollah after achieving longer range missiles. In the early 90s, Iran developed the Shahab-2 missile, similar to the Russian Scud-C. Soon after, Iran created the Shahab-3 missile. With a range of 2,100 kilometers, it can hit targets with over 1 ton of explosives. The Shahab-3 was considered Iran's most important deterrent against Israel's attacks in the 1990s. The most important tests of the Shahab were conducted in the desert of Qom, central Iran. In November 2001, Iran equipped its missiles with cluster warheads. On November 7, 2003, the Washington Post reported that the Islamic Republic of Iran had developed a missile named Shahab-4, but had halted its production. The missile, capable of reaching Europe with a non-nuclear warhead, could pose a threat to Israel if equipped with a heavier weapon. The regime's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, claimed that Iran has two other versions of the Shahab missile, namely the Shahab-5 and the Shahab-6, which have a range of more than 15,000 kilometers and are capable of striking any point on the planet. However, Iran has never commented on these claims. Iran has missiles called the Qadr-F and the Qadr-H. These missiles can be prepared for firing in less than 30 minutes and are considered tactical weapons with a range of 1,650 kilometers. Some categorize these missiles as hypersonic. Iran has also designed a missile named the Qiyam without wingtips, giving it extremely high radar evasion capability. Arming the Guillaume for firing takes only 20 minutes. Seji is a different type of Iranian missile with a two-stage engine that runs on solid fuel. It is a mid-range missile with an operating range of 1,900 kilometers. Sejil can cover the distance from Natanz, which Israel aspires to hit, to Tel Aviv in less than 7 minutes. The Sejil 2 has a wingtip on the cap, significantly increasing its accuracy to below 50 meters. The Sejil 2 is guided through a combination of inertia, cap, and accurate gyroscopes with GPS positioning. Iran's missile experience, which began with Scud missiles, gradually led to the development of the Imad precision strike missiles. Imad has a range of 1,700 kilometers and features a warhead with wingtips, allowing Iranian users to guide it until the moment of impact. Unlike ballistic missiles, which hit targets like a stone after the warhead engine shuts off, Imad dives towards the target like a guided projectile. On February 13, 2024, Iran conducted a different experiment. The Aerospace Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps fired a series of Imad and Qadr F missiles with guided warheads at a specific target. The Palm Achim Air Base, the main location where Israel's F-35 fighter jets are kept. The Israeli Prime Minister had threatened Iran militarily at this base, with the American F-35 fighter behind him. The Palm Achim base is about 15 kilometers long. Iran simulated the plane hangar map for the test. Impact points were recorded by remote control cameras known as GoPro. Warheads of the missiles were non-explosive to accurately calculate the point of impact. After traveling about 1,500 kilometers, the Imad missiles hit the simulation targets and tents with high accuracy of 4 meters. This is a scene of the warhead hitting without a missile and the volume of dust rising due to the impact of the warhead. If the missiles were equipped with their famous high explosive warheads, a hell of fire would form at the impact site. In 2007, Iran tested a missile named Ashura. Iran's defense minister stated that the missile had an operational range of 2,000 kilometers. Uzi Rubin, the former head of Israel's missile department, reacted by saying, "If the information about this missile is correct, its construction is an important milestone in Iran's missile program." Ashura uses solid fuel, which greatly reduces the possibility of tracking the rocket launcher by satellites and aerial radars, and allows the missile to be transferred from one point to another. The military official from the Israeli regime also stated that the missile can hide and its preparation for launch does not require much time.
Obviously, then you can see here a picture which we found one very short clip of a solid propellant test in Iran. They are so proud and they're releasing. Sometimes I think the security forgets to screen things out. So this is a very short clip of about 2 seconds in one of the movies about their armament industry. 30 months later, 2.5, not bad at all for the time. The first Ashura took off. We don't have a picture of that because it's in the release. This is a construction by the American Missile Defense Agency. Slide of General Obering. I took this part. He gave me the slide. So 30 months from end of development of the solid propellant motors till first flight. Not bad. But what's more impressive, that 12 months later, this was failed. 12 months later, they fired the second one. It failed also. They recovered, and in 6 months only, they fired a successful one. What does it mean? It means they know what they are doing. They have good program management, they have good system engineering, they have the engineering talent, and they have all the infrastructure they needed.
Iran produced the Kheibar and Khorramshahr series of missiles. Accuracy of these missiles is less than 10 meters, and at a range of 2,000 kilometers, their accuracy is below 30 meters. The guidance and control system operates in the middle phase of the flight, with guidance occurring outside the Earth's atmosphere. Upon leaving the atmosphere, missile's main engine shuts off when the fuel runs out and its warhead separates. Four small control motors and four small guidance motors outside the atmosphere guide the warhead. This missile can change and correct its direction outside the atmosphere, making it very difficult to intercept by anti-ballistic missile defense systems. As it moves towards the target, the missile rotates and its warhead rains down on the target, breaking into 80 smaller rockets near the target. This missile poses a serious threat to Israel as it covers all parts of the occupied territories. Iran's missile power is based on the Scud missiles it acquired at the beginning of the Iran-Iraq War. Through reverse engineering, Iran developed its own technology. But are these few missiles all Iran can muster to fight the Israeli regime?
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinda ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Please stay tuned.
روایت از نبی اکرم است می‌فرمایند که فإن البيوت إذا كثر فيه تلاوة القرآن ك
There is a narration by the Prophet of Islam in which he says, "The house in which the Holy Quran is recited will be filled with divine blessings and is safe from afflictions." So, brothers and sisters, the more the Holy Quran is recited in a house, the more your house will be filled with divine light of Allah. As a result, the calamities will decrease and the divine blessings will increase. In another narration, it is mentioned that the gates of heaven will be open in several cases. The first case is when there is rainfall. It is also recommended to pray for yourself and others during rainfall. That would be the time for answering your prayers.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
یکی از مواقیت دیگرش موقع اذانه، موقعی که اذان میگن دعا کنید.
The second occasion is when the adhan is given. Now, it may be that someone else is giving adhan, but you can pray at that time for yourself and your family members. This time will be very useful, and that's a good time for answering your prayers. Another case is when the Quran is recited. When the Holy Quran is recited, the doors of heaven will be open to you, and your call upon Allah will be answered. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Till another episode and another short speech of a great alim or a scholar, fi amanillah, God bless you all.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The COP16 Environmental Summit has ended in disarray and indecision. with developing nations furious at unmet funding promises. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. A global summit on halting the destruction of nature ended in disarray on Saturday, 2nd of November, with some breakthroughs but key issues left unresolved. Governments have been meeting in Cali, Colombia, for the first time since a 2022 deal to stop the human-caused destruction of life on Earth. Countries hope to make progress during the two-week summit on crucial targets such as protecting 30% of the Earth for nature and reforming parts of the global financial system that damages the environment. Negotiations were due to finish on Friday, 1st of November, but ended in confusion on Saturday morning, 2nd of November, after almost 12 hours of talks. Governments failed to reach a consensus on key issues, such as nature funding and how this decade's targets would be monitored. Many were forced to leave the talks early to catch flights back home, and negotiations were suspended at 8:30 a.m. on Saturday, 2nd of November, when fewer than half of the countries were present. And the meeting lost quorum. Countries will need to continue the talks next year at an interim meeting in Bangkok, Thailand. A number of countries expressed fury at the way the talks had been dragged out and the order of discussions, which left crucial issues undecided at the final hour. The Brazilian negotiator, Maria Angelica Iqueda, at the summit said, "We really questioned the lack of legitimacy of discussing such an important issue at the end of the COP16 summit. We should have started discussing these issues at the beginning. We should have decisions guaranteeing that we have the resources that we need." The negotiator from Fiji, Michelle Balekaneka, emphasized that many developing nations who did not have budgets to change flight plans were forced to abandon the meeting. Balekaneka said, "Unfortunately, Fiji is the only remaining Pacific Island nation present at the COP16 summit. We came as a delegation of 10 members, and I'm the only one left. We cannot afford to be changing flights because we don't have the funds." Governments were able to make some significant breakthroughs. They agreed on a global levy on products made using genetic data from nature, potentially creating one of the world's largest biodiversity conservation funds, and formally incorporated indigenous communities in the official decision-making of the United Nations biodiversity process, in what negotiators described as a watershed moment for indigenous representation. But while the Digital Sequence Information Fund plan passed at this meeting, it was unclear whether there were enough countries still present to formalize the vote. If not, countries could question the legitimacy of the decision at a later date. Observers said that despite the agreements, the COP16 summit fell short of what was needed to halt the crisis in the natural world, warning that many governments and United Nations officials were not acting with the required urgency. They pointed to a lack of leadership from the European Union, from Canada, and from the United States, who had played a role in helping to reach agreements on this decade's targets just 2 years ago. During the summit, it became clear that many countries were making weak or no progress at all on crucial aims such as reforming environmentally harmful subsidies, protected areas, and even submitting national plans for meeting the targets. Oscar Soria, the director of the think tank The Common Initiative, said, "We saw insufficient leadership from the wealthier countries such as the European Union and France in particular, from Canada, Switzerland, Japan and Britain." Brian O'Donnell, director of the Campaign for Nature, said, "Too many countries and United Nations officials came to Cali, Colombia, without the urgency and the level of ambition needed." The world doesn't have time for business as usual, he said. The suspension of the COP16 summit without any agreement upon finance strategy is alarming. The pace of COP16 negotiations did not reflect the urgency of the crisis we are facing, according to Catherine Weller, Director of Global Policy at Fauna and Flora. Catherine Weller added, despite the hard-won breakthrough on creating a fund for profits from nature's genetic information and ongoing rhetoric about the urgency of scaling up finance for nature, there has not been significant headway made on how we have financed nature recovery, nor clarity on how we monitor progress at a global level. 2 years on, the vast majority of nature targets agreed in Montreal, Canada, regrettably still feel like unfunded words on paper only. The French national broadcaster France 24, France 24, has also covered the same story. The biggest conference on nature conservation worldwide, COP16, came to a close on Saturday, 2nd of November. But participants stopped short of making a decision on one of the biggest demands of the summit, agreeing on a detailed plan to increase funding for biodiversity. The world's biggest nature conservation conference closed in Cali, Colombia, on Saturday, 2nd of November, with no agreement on a roadmap to ramp up funding for species protection. The 16th Conference of Parties to the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity was suspended by its president, Susana Muhammad, as negotiations ran almost 12 hours longer than planned, and delegates started leaving to catch flights back home. The exodus led the summit without a quorum for decision-making, but the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity spokesman David Ainsworth told Agence France-Presse it will resume at a later date to consider outstanding issues. The conference, the biggest meeting of its kind yet, with around 23,000 registered delegates, was tasked with assessing and ramping up progress towards an agreement reached in Canada 2 years ago to halt humankind's rapacious destruction of nature. The Kunming-Montreal Global Biodiversity Framework that emerged from that meeting 2 years ago had set 23 targets to be met in just over 5 years from now. They include placing 30% of land and sea under protection and 30% of degraded ecosystems under restoration by 2030, reducing pollution and phasing out agricultural and other subsidies harmful to nature. The Montreal summit in Canada had also agreed that $200 billion per year be made available to protect biodiversity by 2030, including the transfer of $30 billion per year from richer countries to poorer nations. The actual total for 2022 was about $15 billion, according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. On top of that, nations have pledged about $400 million to a global biodiversity framework fund, created last year to meet the United Nations targets. In Cali, Colombia, negotiators were split largely between poor and rich countries as they haggled over increased funding and other commitments. The biggest demand from the summit to lay out a detailed funding plan turned out to be a bridge too far. Susana Muhammad, Colombia's environment minister, had offered a draft text proposing the creation of a dedicated biodiversity fund, which was rejected by the European Union, Switzerland and Japan. Developing nations had insisted on the creation of a dedicated biodiversity fund, saying they are not adequately represented in existing mechanisms, including the GBFF, the Global Biodiversity Framework Fund, which they say is too onerous.
you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and our guest speaker, Sheikh Javid. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. It's a couple of episodes that we've been engaged in talking about and discussing some of the jurisprudential laws about leadership and religious authorities. I asked you many questions in previous episodes regarding, for example, the sources on which the jurists rely to infer legal rulings. A question which is somehow relevant to these types of questions or questions harmonious with these issues is that, to what extent is the edict or fatwa of the leader of Muslims applicable? That, for example, when it conflicts, like some of the rulings, legal rulings, I mean, conflict with the opinion of the most learned marja or religious authority, which one is to be acted upon and given priority?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is obligatory for all Muslims to obey the fatwa of the ruling religious authority or wali faqih. And the fatwa of the marja cannot be or cannot make it ineffective. Because of the fact that the wali faqih or the ruling authority, religious authority, is better cognizant of the Muslim affairs. And in case his fatwa has something to do with the overall interest or the general interest of Muslims and also the administration of the Muslim society and Islamic country, then it becomes actually mandatory for all Muslims to act according to it, to follow it, even if it contradicts the opinion of his mujtahid. So the opinion of the ruling religious authority precedes the ruling of one's mujtahid, who one should follow in personal issues, in absolutely personal issues.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yes. Well, are Sharia rules alterable or revocable when the jurist leader passes an edict or a fatwa that contradicts those rules due to the public interest of Muslims or even Islam?
Well, it depends from time to time and situation to situation. Sometimes the public interest requires the jurist to give a fatwa different from the Sharia rule. Okay?
Mm.
And this is to be just in a nutshell. Okay? But, okay, to give example, it depends on the situation. Sometimes, actually, the mujtahid, the ruling religious authority, is compelled to issue a fatwa. Like, for example, when it comes to jihad, when it comes to, let's say, defending the Muslim territory and protecting the interests of Muslims, it is the ruling religious authority who should decide and give fatwa.
Yes.
Okay? Because he is better informed and he is better cognizant of the developments taking place around him.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and just with our guest speaker, we are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws about leadership or religious authorities. Sheikh Javid, could someone who does not believe in the absolute authority of the jurist leader be considered a true Muslim?
Well, of course, he is a Muslim. There is no doubt about it, because it's not a fundamental of faith to believe in Vilayat Faqih, or to believe in the absolute authority of a ruling religious authority, is not a principle of faith or a root of religion. So the lack of belief, whether based on ijtihad or taqlid, in the absolute authority of the ruling religious authority during the period of occultation of the Imam al-Hujjah, Ajallallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, of course does not lead to apostasy, and every individual remain a Muslim. He is treated as Muslim, of course.
I see. Well, does the jurist leader enjoy a kind of authority that enables him to abrogate or cancel basically religious laws or Sharia laws for such reasons as public interests of the Muslims?
Well, the religion of Islam was perfected during the time of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and every Muslim individual, whether Shia or Sunni, believes that the religion of Islam was perfected and completed during the time of the Holy Prophet, shortly before his demise. Okay, so it is, of course, not alterable. Abrogation of the rules of Sharia is not possible at all following the demise and the death of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. So there, it is not possible for an individual to add something to the religion or omit something from the religion. Otherwise, it's considered as bid'ah. When you add something to the religion which is not part of the religion, it is considered, in legal terminology, it is considered to be bid'ah. Mm-hmm. And bid'ah is absolutely forbidden, because it's not permissible to innovate something and consider it as part of the religion when it's indeed not part of it. Under any circumstances, it cannot be considered. So it is, let us be short. Alteration that takes place in the subject of, let's say, or the emergence of necessity or exigency, or the existence of a temporary obstacle and implementing a rule, does not constitute abrogation. Okay. For example, when something temporary, when an exigency temporarily arises, and the mujtahid, based on his understanding and on the interest of the Muslims, gives a fatwa, it does not mean abrogation, it does not mean innovation, okay? So the fatwa can be very much transient, it can be for a short period of time, and when that exigency is removed, then the fatwa will cease to exist in that case.
I see. Thank you very much. Let's actually take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio. Stay with us.
Allah, la ilaha illallah. Allah, la ilaha illallah. Allah, la ilaha illallah.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. Ashur Chavid, our guest speaker. The topic is still some of the jurisprudential laws concerning religious authorities and leadership. Sheikh Chavid, when I asked you the previous question before the break, you talked about innovation or bid'ah. And you said that it's not allowed actually in Islam. But I think we need to pause here a little bit and talk about it because, you know, well, what do you mean by bid'ah or innovation? Because some of the rules might be based on, as you said, the religious authorities' understanding, right?
Yes.
According to the emergency that happens today, some of the subjects did not exist in the Prophet's time.
Right.
We all know.
Yeah.
And some of the subjects just happen today in this day and age. I mean,
yeah,
in modern
the cyberspace,
life.
Cyberspace, the digital.
Exactly. So some of these issues appear to be very new and innovated.
Yeah.
So do you, in fact, reject all of these religious rulings because they are somehow new and modern?
No, I think we need to correct ourselves and also our understanding of what
bid'ah is.
Bid'ah is, of course, Islam is not opposed squarely to modernity or modernism or
modern issues.
Yeah, modern
or
issues
or technologies,
yes, because they are there,
mm-hmm.
and we cannot do anything about them. Of course, you know, the thing is that it is the duty of religious authority, of the religious authority, the mujtahid, to give his opinion regarding unclearly defined issues.
Mm-hmm.
Those issues about which there is not a clear and explicit fatwa or ayah in the Holy Quran or any explicit saying from the Holy Prophet.
Mm-hmm.
And we are supposed to follow that the qualified mujtahid, in those areas only, in those areas in which there is no clearly defined fatwa or statement
mm-hmm.
about it.
I see.
And, of course, the mujtahid also is responsible to give his opinion and declare his position regarding new things happening. وَأَمَّا الْحَوَادِثُ الْوَاقِعَةِ فَرْجُعُوا فِيهَا إِلَى رَوَاتِ حَدِيثِنَا. Okay? When new things happen, then the people should turn to the mujtahid, okay, those who are well acquainted with the traditions of the Prophet and the traditions of the infallible Imams. So, whenever a new thing occurs or happens, we should turn to our mujtahid and take their opinion regarding those issues. That doesn't mean they are actually giving their thoughts on based on their own personal understanding, okay. Their own personal desires or things. They turn to the Holy Quran. They have certain general principles and criteria based on which they actually infer the laws and then finally come with their opinion about that new issue.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Chavid. And thank you, actually, my own listeners for your listening to your own program, Islamic Laws on Iran Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, the host of this program, and Sheikh Chavid, the guest speaker of this program, Islamic Laws, and the rest of the crew, we bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
The
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
No end in sight to Israel's indiscriminate strikes across the Gaza Strip, as more civilians, mostly women and children, are killed across the Palestinian territory. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah conducts fresh retaliatory operations against Israeli targets in the occupied territories. Also in the headlines, Iran rejects the U.S. claim that it was involved in devising plots to assassinate American officials as baseless fabrications made by Zionists and anti-Iran circles. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Palestinians in Gaza are going through another day of bloodshed as the Israeli military continues to pound the blockaded territory with more air and artillery strikes. In one of the deadliest attacks, over a dozen people were killed after Israeli warplanes bombed tents of displaced Palestinians in the southern city of Khan Yunis. Several others were injured, including one critically. Also in the south, Israeli ships opened fire on Palestinians on the beach of Rafah, killing a fisherman and injuring several others. The Israeli military also bombed a school in the Al-Tufa area, northeast of Gaza City, killing at least five and injuring several. The U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza began in October of last year. Since then, more than 43,500 Palestinians have been killed and over 102,000 others injured. In yet another brutal attack, the Israeli regime has targeted the tents of displaced Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Gaza, killing two civilians and injuring several others. Our correspondent in Gaza, Abu Bakr Abed, joined us earlier to give us an update on that.
It's been very hectic, very chaotic here inside the hospital as another targeting of a tent inside one of the tented camps in the hospital has just occurred. One of our colleagues has been wounded and he's inside the hospital being treated at the moment. When we talk about this tented camp of more than 10 tents where people, like many people, are taking shelter, many people were wounded at the same time. You can see behind me how people are sobbing in pain, how people are now grieving the loss of their loved ones, of their families and of everyone. So it's a very chaotic situation inside the hospital. There are still injuries coming inside, and not only inside the hospital, because this attack has been the ninth on the hospital since the start of the genocide, and particularly this is the ninth since the last attack on the hospital where people were burned alive. We could see the images coming out from here. They were absolutely horrifying.